Okay.
The font may not be big enough now, I realise. The font?
It's okay.
Anything crucial life will be there.
Not as far as I know, it does not allow you
to... Can you not test
tags?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll just wait till then. I wouldn't want to interrupt.
Any kind of bag that you can just jump to.
Russ and I did try to talk through this, and I think I have taken a unilateral decision, I don't think he had anything to do with it, that I would go ahead and give the talk, possibly directing some of the points to Russ, if I think that there are points he would have picked, or he has already picked up on, and has questions.
Solution, yeah.
Not that I can see. The difficulty with Russ giving this is partly, I think, that there are many more layers to it than I had first thought, and I think we would have needed longer to do it. We would have had to think about it before the conference, and maybe me send 500,000 words or so to him, and him think about it a little bit more. We discovered quickly in our brief conversation at lunchtime that although he has read Heidegger, the mere mention of Kant made him glaze over. So, since it has an effect on most men in my life, I'm not going to enter too much Kant. Okay, my main point is this, that I believe that active agency, embodied active agency, and I'll qualify embodied in a second, is necessary for the development of phenomenal consciousness. So I would go some way with Nick and say that there's a sensory consciousness that underpins the development of phenomenal consciousness, but I think that not all of sensation can be separated from phenomenal consciousness or from phenomena. And I think that phenomenal consciousness is an agency then, are the underpinnings of the development of self, or what Igor Alexander calls depiction, or what I shall misrepresent Heidegger, what Heidegger would refer to as Dasein, but I'm taking Dasein only to be being there, and in a Humean way, the self is simply a instantaneous perception or percept. And there is nothing, there's no greater duration to the self than that. I take Kant's view that the self cannot be awarded a greater, or attributed a greater set of properties or characteristics than is being required for thought. And that thought being evidence for its existing in the first place. What I do think happens when we develop selves is that we are community beings, we are social beings, selves and can only really develop through subjectivity, and we develop persons from that, and persons are narratives, and they can be external narratives, people talking about us, describing us, giving us characteristics. We know that we do this all the time with babies, with small children, even with our pets, we give them characteristics, we tell stories about them, certainly I do about my cats, and about most people's children. And we also tell stories about ourselves, so the narratives are both ways. Okay. So this is the basic... Shall I increase the font?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It means coming out of it ever so slightly, but it's not bad. Okay. A bit more. And I can scroll down. I'm back. That's the Emperor of Ice Cream. A wonderful poem, but not one I'm going to use. Okay. Is that any better? A little bit better? A tad, as they say. First person phenomenal consciousness is fundamental to the organism. I think that's true, but I am... I'm talking about the human organism. Right. But this is partly through conversations with Nick, but it's partly also to do with conversations that I've had over a number of years with people like Sean about proprioception and the hidden sixth sense. So I think that there is another kind of consciousness that underpins first-person phenomenal consciousness. But it's certainly fundamental for the human organism. I believe this comes with an agency, self-directed... with an organism, self-directed agency in its world, so it's Umwelt. And I'm sure you're all familiar with the term from von Erkschul, but I don't know how to pronounce his name, but Jack will know.
Yeah.
Okay, well, John will probably know. Righto. Consciousness of oneself as an agent requires some level of intersubjective or empathic second-person engagement, and this provides the basis for I thoughts in linguistic entities, but it's possible in other social entities, and I think that's probably what will give Nick hiccups, I'm hoping it will. But I, a few years ago, wrote an article on deception in non-human animals, and I think if they're capable of deception, they're capable of some, at least elementary theory of mind, and if they're capable of that, they must have some sense of themselves in relation to this other, and this other has thoughts that they don't have.
What I find difficult is your statement that self is just a momentary, evanescent act of being the sort of sensation, and with no thickness, no lasting.
I think there is a thickness, which I will come to, but it's a thickness which I think happens over the duration of a thought. But the duration of a thought can be quite a long thing, and it needn't be a propositional thing. But there is a thickness to the concept of self, even though it sounds like it's a thin concept of self I'm producing.
Okay, but when consciousness of oneself as an agent, I mean, you can't be conscious of an instant.
The instant is my concept of self. When humans are this is one of the reasons I dropped Russ from what was going to be a dialogue, because he said he wouldn't get past the first slide.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you're doing Russ's job, which is, well, he at least predicted it, so I anticipated it might happen. Humans' notion of the self is a synchronic self. It's instantaneous and there's no longer than that. I think I have a diachronic notion of self. So when I say it's Humean, I should say it's Hume-like. I think it's diachronic, but it's not diachronic in the sense that most people use the term self, as ourselves going through the world. I don't think selves go through the world.
But if everybody else uses the word like that, then you're choosing to...
Well, then we'll have to think of a neologism. Okay, we're going to move a little further. It's a sesmet. I'm closer to Galen Strawson's use of self, and certainly he would be sympathetic with what I'm producing. I haven't used the term thick self in this, but that's partly because thick has another connotation in English. Stupid. Thick self. So. But it's one of the reasons I'm avoided using the term. It has a lot of philosophical connotations too. Anyway, I think the persons are social things generated through narratives which can be first, second, and third person. The reason, by the way, I thought that this might give at least Nick hiccups, but it may also give some other people hiccups, is my concept of self, the reason I would say it's thick in duration because it can be over the thought, and the thought can be quite a long thing, even if we are not aware of the duration of the thought. The reason, but I want to say in some sense that it's minimal, because I think that animals can have, not, and I'm not going to say how low I'm going to go in this, right, but I would say that let's say non-human primates, for the sake of argument at the moment, I would say that they have, or can have, a sense of self. They can have a sense of themselves in relation to other things. And I think this is evidenced by things like, examples like Figgins being able to deceive the other chimps. I don't know whether you know of the example. Do you know the example? Is a figure of a chimp? Is it Jane Goodall's?
Yeah, this is the one of hiding.
Hiding bananas.
Not taking the bananas, which it seems.
Yes, and Figgins has to suppress food grunts, because the first time when he's given the bananas, he doesn't suppress the food grunts, and the other chimps come back and they take the bananas. So the next time, he learns pretty quickly. He suppresses the food grunts because he's made this association. And that, at least as far as my argument is concerned, indicates that he's got some sense of himself in relation to these other beings who will act in a way which isn't going to be good for Figgin. It's going to be contrary to what he wants.
So you're going to talk about how Figgin gets from one instant of food.
No.
Food grunt Figgin,
no.
And the no self.
No, I'm not. This is one of the things. This I would like. These are the kind of things I'm putting up for discussion. But in fact, the whole lot will be up for discussion. What I'm actually going to concentrate on is the fundamental element of agency, and I want to concentrate on the element of muscular engagement and how muscular engagement underpins the development of a phenomenal consciousness.
If
Sorry, this may just be a quibble or irrelevant, but if in fact the monkey had a gust of wind had blown the banana out of his hand.
He didn't have a banana.
What was it?
Well, he had a banana, but you mean on the first occasion?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he then suppressed the food grunt whenever there was wind.
I have no idea. This is speculation. Can we come back to that? Because it's taking me way off the point.
I'm just thinking you were making certain very rich attributions.
I was making very rich attributions.
I just wondered.
But it's really not crucial to what I'm going to say. Okay.
You had your chance to give it directly to me.
Okay, can I change my mind? Because if I give it directly to Russ, at least I know what kind of questions you've been asked.
Now, why don't you just go ahead?
Is everybody happy if I go to slide three? You see, I shouldn't heckle, because if I heckle, then when... Heckling here has a bad connotation, doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Heckling in the UK means cajoling, bantering... What is it?
It's usually interrupting a political speech.
What about the workers?
Yes. When are you going to stop beating your wife?
I'm telling myself it's called prefuting the speaker. And tell the speaker what they're about to say and then tell them what's wrong.
Yes, well.
So this is kind of like a food grunt.
No.
I'm sorry.
I've got nothing to.
Get on with it. I'm not
Okay. I want to say that embodied agency is fundamental, but part of the reason I want to qualify the use of embodying, this is going to open up a whole can of worms again, right? So just don't run with the worms this time. Just let them filter through. Okay. My notion of embodiment doesn't necessarily mean physical embodiment. I'm perfectly happy for there to be a system, a virtual system. I'm perfectly happy for there to be a virtual agent that has... that can develop a sense of itself in relation to other virtual agents, that would have I have a sense of my own limits. I know that I can stretch this far and this far, and I know that I go down to about there and up to about here, and I have what seems to me a fairly good physical embodiment. I don't, however, think that my mind stops there or that my body stops there. Now, I think that would be true also of a virtual agent, but I think that you need somewhere
in
which...
Does a virtual agent have a sensory system?
It would have to have a sensory system. It would have to have sensors, transducers, actuators, the whole Google kit and. Okay. So I think that embodied agency is fundamental. I think that we can get this from people like Daniel Stern's work, and I'm not going to go into lots of Daniel Stern's work, but if you want me to, I will, and please don't ask me to now. We have to, if this is true, then we have to understand bodies in a more fundamental way, which is one of the reasons I'm at this conference, because of the, I think that we tend to understand bodies from a third-person perspective. We tend to understand them anatomically. We tend not to think of them as agents within their environment. And as I say, thankfully, over the last few years, I've come across the wonderful writings of people like Merleau Ponty and so on. But we also have to understand the body's consciousness of and in its world. Now, I actually do think that there is a muscular level of consciousness. I think that there is... in my bodily engagement with the world, I am conscious at a bodily level, but I'm also conscious in a muscular way. I anticipate things in a muscular way. I can enact my world in a muscular way, and I'm going to argue for a kind of muscular or kinesthetic, that's even better, imagination. Which is probably going to be a little bit controversial. Well, I'm hoping it will be, because there's no point standing up here and telling you something you accept.
Do you know Derek Pavinelli's speculations about the self coming into being when animals became sufficiently heavy, when they were climbing in the trees, they had to be aware of where their limbs were and what they were doing. And that's why gorillas and chimps became conscious.
I've heard loads of Pavinelli, but I haven't come across that. But that's interesting.
It's very close, I think, for those.
Yes. Yeah. You have a reference, I'm sure?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to elaborate. I'll read this because it is quite small font. I'm going to do two things, I hope, because we'll see what happens. I'm going to elaborate a notion of bodily consciousness the sensory motor kinesthetic system and imagination, bodily imagination that is, established, which I believe is established through a history of active prehension and apprehension. And I'm going to use Whitehead's work here very briefly to do this. I'm also going to try and present a case for bodily imagination as a nomological condition for the application of cognitive imagination and the development of a creative imagination. I don't think, and I will explain what I mean by these three different kinds of imagination. I've now gone off in a direction with Povinelli. I'll have to come back from that, I'm afraid. It's a rather super idea, I think.
Well, the interesting thing is that monkeys with much more with bodies which don't require so much control, thinking about, don't pass the gout narratives.
Yes, that's where my thoughts were going, I'm afraid. Okay, so, are there any... Russ, anything? Go on, because I know there will be.
Take your chances.
I will, I'm going to go quickly on. One of the reasons I'm very fond of Whitehead is because he seems to have developed in the second or the mad stage of his life, as John was saying earlier, a sense of, as Frege talks about grasping in the sense of understanding. Whitehead talks of grasping in the sense of a feeling of feeling it's groping.
Yes.
But John, would that be possible?
No.
Well, you're the Whitehead person, really. I think it wouldn't be.
You carry on.
Not understanding and empathy.
Carry on.
Okay. Well, that's just a thought that came to my head. Okay, Whitehead has a notion of prehension. I'm not going to say too much about apprehension because I think that with apprehension we get a different sense of ourselves. But with prehension, Whitehead says the actual entity, the essence of the actual entity, the organism, I'm going to say, but I know that he means actual entity in a slightly different way than that, consists solely in the fact that it is a prehending thing. It is a feeling thing. It is a sensing thing. It is a thing which engages with its world and responds to its world, reacts to its world. It is, it has an umwelt, and I'm sure that he wouldn't be unhappy with that term at all. You're not. Why not?
Because I think you're doing the right thing if you're translating prehension as what Monique Skrull and Charles Simons Peirce Meyer and the rest of them talk about when they talk about the world having meaning.
Yeah.
You know, the I'm also a Gibsonian, the meaning in the foreign sense of the world is what you can do, what the world will let you do. And if you're about to say that what Whitehead meant by prehension was, you know, grasping that, I don't want to go there because I could fall over that. I'm hungry. That looks like unthinkable. That'll do. You know, Whitehead.
Well, why is that? Why is that not compatible with the organism's coherence with its umwelt? Why is that? Why would that be inconsistent?
I didn't say it was inconsistent.
Okay, that's because I think that's what I asked. Or we should go back on the tape and say it again. I should go on. Because, there's something I really want to add to that. The particular way in which each actual entity prehends the world, the how of its grasping, is its subjective form or affective tone. And I think this is basic for any organism. And I think that it's akin to Heidegger's primary mode of being. It's not a sense of, at that stage, any sense of ownership. I think that possibly comes with the apprehension that Whitehead talks about. But I shouldn't be addressing you at all, because I'm watching, hoping you're going to go like this. And if you don't do it, then I get disappointed, so I'm just going to ignore you for now. Okay. You're going to have a great time transcribing this, aren't you? Okay. I think at heart what I want to say is that there is I'm not sure how far down I would go. I don't think that I would want to go down below anything that has no musculature. I don't think there's a primary mode of being for a cockroach. I think that just doesn't make sense. But I would think there is a primary mode of being possibly for a salamander, definitely for a cat. I don't think I would have any difficulty with that at all. I'm now looking for Nick, hoping he'll nod, so I better not look at anybody and hope anybody nods. Walt, I'll just address you.
I'm just worried about why are you excluding the cockroach? It's got even more legs to control.
It's got more legs to control, that's certainly true, but it doesn't have... What I have is a kind of soft engagement with the world. There's a sort of there's a subtlety to a muscular engagement that there doesn't seem to be in something which is exoskeletal. But I'm not. I mean, this is something I'm happy to discuss, and if we can convince me otherwise, then I'd be delighted, because I have a tendency I think.
Is an extreme case of soft interaction.
I'd like to push it on the virtual level.
Hold on one second. I didn't finish that. I didn't hear the rest of this.
So is there an octopus on the other hand? So
I'm perfectly happy with an octopus.
I think eventually we'll end up with William James's Tottenham worm.
I wouldn't be too unhappy about a worm. I have problems with things which are exoskeletal. So
so you could lose it in evolution. If you became exoskeletal, you could...
Yes.
Was on the list.
Yes. Hold on one second.
Why can't you be continuing to...
Hold on one second. Can I finish this sentence? My difficulty is I tend towards panpsychism. And if I tend towards panpsychism, and that's partly because of Leibniz's influence, if I tend towards panpsychism, then why am I excluding the cockroach for God's sake? Or for anybody's sake, whoever's up there, whoever's down there. Why am I doing that? For the moment, I think the way I'm moving in my thinking is that the subtlety of the sensory motor kinesthetic engagement, the subtlety of the proprioceptive engagement, bodily engagement that I have with my world, that feeling of feeling, the grasping of the possibilities or potentialities in my world, my niche, my umfeld, whatever we want to call it, that's what gives me my primary mode of being. And I don't think that that's possible in something that doesn't have those subtleties.
Well, that's where my question was coming in. Okay. You're opening the door to virtual agents having this, and okay, I'm willing to grant that Rod Brooks's embodied cockroaches today may not have that. But then, what would they have to have? Would they have to have the musculature and your use?
Open question for afterwards.
There was a paper recently on exactly that issue, whether the multitude sense of self to have control of the body and the robot. So there's some discussion.
Of course, but this is taking this off in a way that I don't really want to go, but Igor would probably say that as long as it's got a sense, it's got a depiction, it's capable of depiction, it has a sense of being there, it's got a sense of self. And it's insufficient as far as I can see, but we mustn't walk in that direction. Okay, I'm going to move swiftly on to In Action and Imagination. Of course, we all know Varela Thompson Roche's work on the embodied mind, and if you don't, you should. It's a very, very interesting book, and it's particularly interesting for me because they claim that the body's inquiry about its world is based on the history of the variety of actions that a being in the world performs. So it's not just... a wonderful phrase that Randall gave me last year, felt dynamics, the kind of phrase that I was grappling for last year. We have each of our actions, each of our engagements with the world has an affective tone. And it has, since we are sensing agents, since we are acting agents, it has a sensory affective tone. It is that element that gives it some kind of, I think it's flavour that Searle uses, which I'm not terribly fond of. But in our interactions with the world, those flavors build up, those affective tones build up. We get a sense of ourselves in the world. We get not simply the primary mode of being, but it becomes a phenomenal sense. It becomes a phenomenal consciousness, something more than simply that. But it's through a build-up of experience, a build-up of interaction, intersubjective experience included. Now,
do you want to be interrupted? Because it's...
No, why not?
You're going in an odd direction with this, because you're supposing you're right that phenomenality arises out of this kind of self-dynamics. that's fine, and it may even be so. And I thought about agentic quality, for example, because I was worried about the fact that others end up room for agency.
Yeah. Yeah.
But nonetheless, the primary example most people would always give of phenomenal consciousness is response to stimulation, to light, to sound, to touch, to smell, whatever.
Yes, yes, I agree. But I think there are a lot of sensory experiences that I can have which are low level enough for me not to be aware of them consciously. They don't register, one at a time.
Yeah.
They don't register phenomenally with me. Mm-hmm. That there are many, like looking across here and seeing people with their hands up, seeing people looking interested, hopefully, seeing people nodding occasionally, seeing people look very puzzled occasionally. All of that is open to me consciously, phenomenally. The redness of James's t-shirt, for example, is open, seeing red. But there's an awful lot that I'm doing which is not open to me consciously. It's at a different level, a sensory affective level, but it's not phenomenological.
How do you get the phenomenality of red out of your account so far? I mean, if, like me, you say, well, actually, sensation is a form of action. Mm. You do it, but you haven't said
it. It's because I think that there are. I thought I was moving towards that in my answer. Maybe I didn't get there. We have different kinds of sensors. We have different thresholds of sensory experience, and there are. We have a bombardment of stimuli, and. I better not try and say too many things at once here. A great deal of sensory input does not reach a threshold level that I'm aware of, but I could turn my attention to it. The article in the last journal, Consciousness Studies, Book 1, I think, or maybe it's the last one, about whether I'm constantly aware of my feet and my shoes. And I don't think you are, though I think you could turn your attention to it at any time and you can wiggle your toes and check that your shoes are still on and that kind of thing. But I think that there's a lot of my muscular engagement which through habit becomes, which does not need to be registered unless I'm having to pay attention to it in some way. So if I'm learning to ride a horse, for example, I have to pay attention to the position of my body, to the positions of my of my limbs, the pressure I have on the reins, the relation of the reins to the bits, the pressure on the horse's mouth, and so on. My feet in the stirrups, I'm aware constantly, for at least the first few times I'm on a horse, of where the parts of my body are, and it makes it all very awkward. Now, I realise that at that time, maybe I've gone up and bumped too high a level too quickly. I have gone to too high a level too quickly. That activity quickly becomes, I think if you're anyway good at this or you want to keep going at it, it becomes automated and you become unaware of the sensory affective quality quite often of your limbs and your activity with riding. And eventually it can become as though you and the horse are one organism.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Now, well,
right. Come back
but I know, I'm coming back. Okay. So there are some things, when I'm in this plethora of experience that I'm having, there are some things which grab your attention. This is what John was talking about the other day. There are some things which, like the colour red, which is used always in philosophy, the colour red is one of those things which symbolises all sorts of things to us. Don't eat these berries. So we don't even need to have any proposition about don't eat these berries. We would be wary of, we are wary, somehow primordially, of redness. People are generally wearing fairly flat, muted colours. This is a bright colour. So when you look around and you're looking, for example, the only other person who's wearing, sorry, Claire, a brightish colour is Claire. So that these things catch your attention in ways that others do. They reach a threshold level which is phenomenally there. And there are lots of things that
so
don't.
What are you saying? That if everybody was wearing a bright t-shirt?
This is a different talk.
But what happens when it reaches this threshold? Is it the actual attention?
You might attend to it, or you will attend to it, and if it's going to be important for you in the next thing you're doing, in the choice of potentials that you, the choice of possible actions that you are going to make, then it'll have an affordance for you. If it doesn't have an affordance for you, if it's attracted your, if, I mean, James's t-shirt is, I like bright colors, it's attracted my attention, but it has no affordance for me except as an example here.
So you're not phenomenally conscious of it?
I am phenomenally conscious of it. But I then, it doesn't, when I'm phenomenally conscious of something, I have turned my attention to it. Or when I have turned my attention to it, I am phenomenally conscious of it. Is that okay?
So you're not phenomenally conscious of things in your...
It's at a lower level. I didn't say that. I said it's a lower level. There are different sensory experiences that I can have, and some of them are at a lower left level that they don't reach the threshold that takes my attention to them and holds my attention. We're going on to the next one. Hold it. Hold that thought, Wendell. and just stay still for a while. And that means all of you. You're the only one who hasn't given me any chip yet, Russ. I'm worried.
I'm still taking out dog training.
What?
I'm still taking out dog training.
You see, the fact is, I don't think I'm assertive. I think Jack and I share this non-assertive quality. Okay, we're going to move on to the next one. Oh, no, well, really, I should say a little bit more here, because I do want to say that, you know, over a period of time, we, in our engagement with the world, and it's active bodily engagement that I'm concerned with, but it could be phenomenal level engagement, we begin to build up expectations about how the world will be in a muscular way. I'm going to use Rodney Cottle's term, plenisentient, which means that we are aware with our entire bodies of our world. I mean that I am ready, in a sense. My senses are ready for the experiences. I am aware with the muscles in my eyes. I am aware with the muscles in my legs, my torso, everywhere. No questions, all right?
Can I help you with that question?
Oh, now you tell me. Don't say a thing. Now, with this notion of inaction that Varela, Thompson, Roche discuss, that they introduce, I extend it ever so slightly and say that I actually have a capacity for muscular inaction. My muscles anticipate what the world is going to be like. So I ask questions with my muscular engagement with the world. So when I walk across here and away from my hands and put my head on the floor hoping there'll be no more questions for a few seconds so we get a little further on, when I do all of that, I am asking muscular questions. I'm asking questions about the world, whether the world continues to be the way it was when I last did it. They don't have to be in my phenomenal consciousness, and they don't have to be, they certainly aren't propositionalized. And at the moment when the reason I know that I'm asking questions is that when the expectation or the enacted process is confounded, I'm pulled up short. I'm suddenly aware of myself in the world. And the example I've given before of this is if you're moving on an escalator, quickly your body becomes going down an escalator, not so much going up an escalator, but you're going down an escalator and you're moving with the escalator, you get into a rhythm of movement with the escalator. It's a very even momentum. You're moving in unison. If the escalator has stopped or is stopped as you're doing that, it quickly becomes uneven. The actions become distorted. They become... Disturbed, yeah, that'll do. You become much more aware of yourself in the world. You are...
It's a breakdown,
yeah. So I want to say that it's a breakdown in the expectation that you have, and that can be muscular expectation just as it can be a cognitive expectation.
It's also sensorial expectation.
Yes.
You're expecting a flow,
but that's why,
which isn't there.
But that's why I've said there can be... that the muscular engagement I have with the world is sensory, but it needn't be phenomenal. So far, so good. It needn't be available, exactly. But it becomes available once it's disturbed. And I think at that point we're most poignantly aware of ourselves in the world. But that's a kind of Heideggerian mode, and we're not going to go there because he's read Heidegger, and you could ask me a difficult question. I'm only joking.
Can I?
No! go on. Mm-hmm.
What are you going to say, maybe later, when we talk about something like locked-in syndrome?
Can we keep that for the discussion? Because I think that's a really, really interesting... and there's a... No, we're going to keep it. Trouble is, see, once you raise interesting things, I
hold that thought.
Hold that thought. Okay. Now, Maxine, I met last year, as I said, to a few people, and have read lots and lots of her stuff since. And I really enjoyed Maxine's company last year and the community with her. And she was one of the people who... you see, I'm in a philosophy. Well, I was in a philosophy department for 10 years, and I moved out of the philosophy department because of this dreadful RAE that we have, this fascist RAE, because they said that the work I do is really not philosophy because it's interdisciplinary, and I said stuff you, and I met Maxine, and she said that she's had. All her life, she's now in her 70s, all her life she'd had a struggle with, she was in a philosophy department most of her life, but she had a struggle getting her stuff accepted because it's on movement and the primacy of movement for cognition. I was reading through so much of her stuff, and I had to pick out a small piece that I thought said much of what I want to say, and this was the little quotation I found, which I liked. Any movement creates a distinctive kinetic dynamics in virtue of its spatiotemporal energic qualities. Now, there's nothing there about phenomenal. It doesn't have to be phenomenal. But the energic qualities, I think, emphasize the not only the physical engagement of the system, even the sensory engagement of the system, but also its inaction, also its building of expectation, also its movement and, I don't know, imaginative possible. That's bad. Don't go there. Go stay with inaction. It's inactive quality. And they are when I'm walking across here, I'm not, or when I'm looking around here, I'm not expecting to see my class of rhetoric students. There are spatio-temporal energetic qualities about the kinds of muscular expectations I have. They are contingent on the spatio-temporal characteristic of this particular experience. Now, I have been reading Alexander Lurie for a long time, and Nick has told me one or two things over the last couple of days. I still love his work.
No, I still don't.
You love his work.
I love his work. I said he was a bully.
He was a bully. But I still love his work. And so we're agreed on that.
I spent a month in Bolenko Institute with him and watched him in Metallic, and on Black Friday he bullied people all the time. It was lots.
So hard, isn't it? But what I really thoroughly enjoyed about The Working Brain is that he talks about, and I got this from Maxine as well, so I've only read this over the last year or so, he talks about the creation of muscular melodies, kinesthetic melodies, the sort of engagement we have, and he talks about writing your surname. And so when you start off as a small child and you're writing your surname, or even if you're beginning to write letters, you write it with such attention and the muscles aren't trained and there's an awkwardness to it and you're having to concentrate. It's a little bit like learning to ride a horse, I suppose, or ride a bicycle. But with these letters you're trying to, especially if you've got a teacher who's going to who's keeping an eye on you, you're trying to keep them between two lines and trying to make them all sit on the line and they have to have the right tails and so on and so on. But after a little while you become much more fluent. The writing becomes fluent. The muscles become, through habit and custom, I'm going to use Hume's phrase of through an involuntary leap of, and I'm going to make it a bit wicked, through an involuntary leap of the muscular imagination, we learn to sign our names with a fluidity, with a fluency,
but without any thought. But joined up writing, I mean, that's, but we're taught that as well. We're taught to join one letter to the next and so on. So the joining up process is at first itself a learned thing.
Yeah.
Learning becomes.
Yeah.
But even the individual letters.
But learning this is also part of the habit and the custom. And then the muscles become good at it. It's a little bit like, I'm sure many people here are musicians. And I play saxophone and piano. I don't play saxophone terribly well. I've been thrown out of a number of West of Ireland pubs for playing badly. But anyway,
that's the big drum.
Damn, John, you won't let us tell me.
I think they throw John Coltrane.
I don't.
Or are you?
No, well, actually, I've only been thrown out of one pub, and that was being drunk and playing the saxophone. Badly. Anyway, but I play piano, and I was saying to Nick earlier on that I can now, there's been many, many years of practice, I can play piano and chatter to people, and there's no big problem with it. And this is going to say, I do not want this to sound braggartly, because it really isn't meant that way, but very rarely do I hit a bar note. Right? It's just, as long as it's a piece I'm very familiar with, it has to be a piece I'm very familiar with. When it's Bach's Inventions, it takes a long time, and I get through one of them over a whole Christmas period, usually, very slowly. Well, having mentioned this, Nick, I'm delighted to discover this lovely piece. Thank you very much, I must acknowledge you here, because Richard Dawkins doesn't give you enough acknowledgement for the time he uses you. The Elements of Physiology by Diderot. Diderot actually, again, this is according to Nick's article, The Uses of Consciousness, Diderot refers to this as an unconscious, an example of the unconscious. A musician is at the harpsichord. He is chatting with his neighbour. He forgets that he is playing a piece of concerted music with others. However, his eyes, his ears, his fingers are not the less in accord with them because of it. Not a false note, not a misplaced harmony, not a rest forgotten, not the least fault in time, taste, or measure. Now the conversation ceases, our musician returns to his part, loses his head, and does not know where he has got to. I'm sure we all, if you play an instrument, I'm sure you recognise this. If the distraction of the conscious man had continued for a few more minutes, the unconscious animal in him would have played the piece to the end without his having been aware of it. The rhythm, the harmony, the muscular engagement, the melody that he is, and I don't mean melody, audible melody here, the melody, the muscular melody, has been disturbed. It's been ruptured. The process has been ruptured. He's now aware of himself. He's lost it. It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So thank you ever so much. I shall look for it. Now, okay, we are going to have a little bit of can. This is something I'm interested in doing. So this is something I haven't yet done. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the imagining. By the way, I've never checked. Do I cross the idea?
It's 3 o'clock now, and you should go till about 3:15.
And then we have time for discussion, or is that too much?
Yeah. Well, you can finish by about 10 after.
Okay.
It's not been time, because I know this is interrupting.
Good point. Thank you. Okay, we're going to go for a quarter after then. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to represent Count faithfully, and then I'm going to take him and do horrible things to him, which really hurts me, but there we go. Count is non-committal about the ontology of the mind. Right? He makes no ontological commitment to what kind of thing the mind is. He plays safe all the way through. And I think that he doesn't need to, and I think we can do more with Kant than a lot of the Kant studio and scholars would like us to do. He talks about, he splits the imagination into two parts. He says that there's a cognitive imagination and a creative imagination. I think that his cognitive imagination can be, split again, but I'll explain that. The creative imagination is very easy to explain, we're all aware of this. By the way, it's the same split that William James makes, except William James doesn't go into so much detail with it. But William James makes a distinction between two kinds of imagination, the reproductive and the productive imagination. The reproductive imagination for Kant is, as I say, the one we're familiar with, bringing to mind absent objects. So Claire's example of being somewhere else, even though she was here, being able to bring to mind the absent objects. The novel juxtaposition of things, so being able to put... I don't know what I mean, I'm not going wrong with that. Okay, but Kant then has a very interesting analysis he does of what he calls the cognitive imagination or productive imagination. And he means it in a very clear cognitive realm. How do I conceptualize my world? How do I apprehend and conceptualize my world? How do I make sense of the world? I think that this can be extended to how does my body make sense of it as well. Kant makes three kinds of, he says there are three parts to imagination. There's the apprehension of things, and he doesn't mean the self-prehension here. He simply, I think we can take him to mean apprehension in a prehensive sense. I am feeling, grasping, perceiving, sensing the world around me. There is a temporal distinction to the now moment. It's got a greater sensory impact. It's got a greater sensory power. It's reached a threshold that the then moment no longer has. The now moment is always the one that's up there. So I'm aware of the present as being temporally distinct from the past. I'm able to, if I'm looking at something, he gives the example of a line, in fact. That's not fair to do it there. You can imagine this. He gives the example in the Critique of Pure Reason of a line, and he says we would have no sense, we would have no understanding of the concept of a line if we were not able to reproduce the parts of it. So as I look along, you have to imagine there's a line here that I'm now drawing in space. And Kant says, if all I could have is the now moment, I would not be able to have a concept of line. I would be able to have a concept of point. So I have to be able to reproduce at every temporal experience of now, the little past impression. No, not yet. No, because this is hard. This takes me a couple of lectures with the students. And you're getting it now at 4 minutes. I think that maybe a nice example is, how do I understand that this is a watch? I don't see the whole watch at one time. You think you see the whole watch at one time. You see parts of the watch, and you link them, you reproduce them. There's a contiguity to the parts of the watch in space and in time, and you are forced through, and I will use Hume here, I'll use him properly, through an involuntary leap of the imagination. You are forced to conjoin them. So we are able to prehend our world, we are able to grasp it, we are able to sense it, we are able to experience it, and I mean experience very minimally there at that point. We are able to reproduce the past moments with the now, and we are able to then develop this into the recognition or re-identification of a particular object, like the identification of a watch. But it needn't necessarily be something which we name. It needn't necessarily be something which we propositionalize, because I would be perfectly happy, although I know that this might go against the grain, and I do not want to open up to more discussion at the moment, but it would be, I think that it's perfectly possible for animals to do this kind of re-identification. That's enough for that. Each aspect of apprehension and reproduction, and a great deal of the re-identification, I think, is done pre-reflectively. And we'll stick with the term we settled on yesterday. Kant would say that all these things happen. They don't happen a priori. That's a lie. They happen pre-reflectively. The re-identification can be something which is open to consciousness, which is phenomenally there, and which is, we are accessing to use. It's open to access consciousness. This productive imagination, this apprehension, this reproduction, all of these things are goal-directed and intentional, and can be, but are not always, and I've said this too many times already, phenomenologically hidden to the agent. The hierarchy of experience, bodily consciousness is logically and more primitive than pre-reflective consciousness, and thus also self-reflective consciousness. The content is non-conceptual. I can see Walt looking at his watch, so I'll hurry up. The content is non-conceptual, and it depends on perceptual, kinesthetic, proprioceptic feedback. I can see the mouth opening. And the intake of breath, not happening yet. Okay, I've got a couple. We don't really need to back. All I'm going to do is make an appeal to an authority here, Merleau-Ponty, but an appeal to authority is really what most of us do a lot of the time. But it's not very useful for the rest of this. I think I've given you most of what I want to say. This says the life of consciousness, cognitive life, the life of desire or perceptual life is subtended by an intentional arc which projects around us our past, our future, our human setting, our physical, ideological, and moral situation. But it's much faster than I actually need for this, and I shouldn't have put him in, it's just I like him. This is something which is controversial. This is something which I'm trying to develop, and I should spend more time with it. But what I want to say is that these moments of apprehension and reproduction, the feeling of the inaction of, so I can anticipate them. This is paradoxical for Husserl. Husserl says when you're listening to a piece of music, you're expecting the piece that's coming. But you're also, so you're anticipating the piece, the next few notes. But you're also somehow remembering what has been. And all of this is happening in the now. And you think this is a paradoxical situation. How can you be having in the now moment the future and the past? And I think that it's not impossible, but it takes something like David Bohm's rather curious take on the world to provide us with some kind of answer. And as I say, this is something I'm thinking of, or I'm attempting to develop, but it hasn't happened yet. It would take us a lifetime, it would take us at least another 10 minutes or so to go through this in more detail. So I will try to do this rather quickly. Bohm says that there's an explicate order, the kind of order that we have externally that we use for our general physics, the kind of things that we are aware of, the kind of things that we help us in our explanations. Or Van's eyes have just got wider and wider. I'm not sure why that is. Okay, but I think that we can solve Husserl's paradox, and we can solve Kant's notion of reproduction and apprehension and reproduction by using some kind of intricate order, and that will help us in the kind of now and enacted moment we have with our muscular engagement with the world. And the intricate order is this what he calls the unfolded order. It's special, it's distinguished from contained within the general totality of all the implicate orders. But it is something I'm still developing, still thinking about, but I think it's one way that I can begin to address the Husserl paradox, the Kant situation of being able to remember the points of the line at the same time I'm having the now experience, being able to build up the reproduction, and being able to build up a picture of inaction when it comes to muscular engagement with the world. It's horribly tricky. Okay, so I propose that in the establishment of kinesthetic melodies, our body has the capacity to enfold past experience into the now experience, to yield a possible future experience in the present moment. And I think it's going to be interesting work when I get the chance to develop it, but if good, okay. I'm not going to say more about that, and I'm not going to say more about that, although I could, and I would like to tell you lots about spinal cord, and I'm going to leave it there. What I will do is quickly just give you a little run through some beautiful poetry. Because I have been reading poetry all my life, I imagine everybody here does. Although actually I have discovered that it's not true that everybody reads poetry. I love all sorts of poets. Jeremiah Hopkins is one of my favourites. It's impossible not to love him. But one of the wonderful things I like about Hopkins is his engagement with the world. It seems to me that it is a full-bodied, embedded engagement, and the poor guy was a Jesuit. And if you read his manuscripts, he's got a little OH at the top of some of his manuscripts. I don't know whether you know what OH means in his manuscripts. It means old habits. It refers to onanism. Yeah, it's very peculiar. So when he, because he feels very guilty about it, and he writes it, and anyway, but this is beautiful. It's degged with dew, dappled with dew, are the groins of the braes that the brook treads through, wiry heath packs, flitches of fern, and the bead bonny ash that sits over the burn. I like it because it's got so many. It's a bodily poem.
It's a very conventional.
It's got a very conventional meter. Yes, I think it must be. You're a Hopkins person as well, I believe, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. In Rusnay, I think it's an early poem. Let me go quickly on. This is just the Seamus Heaney. That's actually the third verse, by the way. It isn't the whole poem. The whole poem.
On Hopkins, the end of my book, when I discuss with the same issues as you're doing, Kingfisher's Catch, Kingfisher's Catch Fire, which has a line perfectly. I'm not going to like my. For what I do, I am, for that I care.
That's lovely. Mm. Absolutely lovely. So look at something. Anyway, Chambertini, I know this isn't big enough to read, and I probably won't go, but Chambertini is a lord among poets, so he's just wonderful. I like Heaney more than Yeats, I'm afraid, but then that's big. Anyway, I'm not going there. The part of this which his poems are so, they're so earthy, the cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and the slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head, that I've no spade to follow men like them. And this is about his father, who's a turf cutter, who's a farmer, and he isn't made for the soil, he isn't made for philosophy, he's made for writing, and so that his pen, between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it. It's absolutely beautiful. I know this is an unconventional way to finish a talk, but at least it's keeping you distracted for a while. Wallace Stevens. I mean, there's just so much of Wallace Stevens, and I could have given you the Emperor of Ice Cream, which is my favourite, but it would be wrong. Like a dull scholar, I behold in love an ancient aspect touching a new mind. That's beautiful. It comes, it blooms, it bears its fruit and dies. This trivial trope reveals a way of truth. Our bloom is gone. We are the fruits thereof. Two golden birds descended on our vines into the autumn weather, splashed with frost, distorted by hail fatness, turned grotesque. Thanks, absolutely. You feel you... It's a poem you eat, isn't it? We hang like warty squashes streaked and rayed. The laughing sky will see the two of us washed into rinds by rotting winter rains. It's not just an earthiness, it's a bodily... Maybe it's just me, maybe it's an age thing. I don't know what it is. And then Walt Whitman, because it's the body electric, and you all know that. I sing the body electric, the armies of those I loved engirth me, and I engirth them. They will not let me off till I go with them, respond to them, and discorrupt them, which I think is beautiful. And charge them full with the change of the soul. If poets can create neologisms, why can't we? And I think that could be it. It is it. I had lots of notes, but I thought that'd be it. And Russ, not an interjection.
Sorry, I'm still on the first slide.
Okay.
Can we have you on the slide?
Yes, yeah. Are you back up now?
No, will you send me on?
Oh, certainly, yes. Have you... I was at a meeting in Durham University, and Sean Gallagher was chairing. And Sean said, after a few minutes, he said, "Okay, are there any more questions? The idea seems to be to catch Susan out. So, are you ready? Do you want to try this again?" Well, have I warned you? Oh no, I didn't think that.
I had a question. I was just suggesting in the earlier part of your presentation, you seemed awfully close to Demise here.
Yes, I think...
I have a feeling that his notion of the protos, the mapping of the proto-cell down to the level of the chemical balance in every cell would somehow be helpful in terms of...
He goes further down than I want to go, because he's talking about homeostatic and regulatory functions and so on,
sure.
And those are also part of the proto-cell.
Well, he feels that that's contributing to the
whole body. Yeah. I don't know enough
about
it, but I agree.
Similar thought, just... Wondering if you're familiar, you undoubtedly are, with Howard Gardner, and because of these things from a different, the same issues really, but from a different perspective, you know.
Have you a reference, a particular reference for anything you would think that would be?
I'm trying to remember which is the one in which he presents it. There's Frames of Mind is one of them.
Ah, yes.
And
yes.
There's another one I can't quite think of right now. Two books. The first one basically presents his notion of the multiple intelligences that each of us has a somewhat different IQ, you might call it, including...
That's the stuff I remember most.
...genetic ones.
Yeah. I think I've used his work when explaining to students that this was in relation to machine consciousness, and I got there sort of through talking about different kinds of intelligence. And what I said, you know, years ago we would not have thought of David Beckham as being an intelligent guy, but now we do.
Right.
And that was using Howard Gardner.
Yeah, that would be a good
time. Freddie, don't go for a long, because I can't follow that.
I have one for you.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, good, because mine is so Western oriented.
No, this is not.
Oh, it is. Okay,
well, I know that you don't like exoskeletons or you don't like.
I do. I love insects. That's the only thing I love in insects.
But have you heard this one about the centipede?
Go on then.
The centipede.
Go on.
The centipede was happy, quiet, until one day the ant in Chuan said, "Pray which leg goes after which?" This put her up in such a stitch. She lay dejected in a ditch, considering how to run.
Oh, but so often that happens to us, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's you're talking
to somebody, you can walk along the footpath or the plane, what's it called, sidewalk, and you can go off the sidewalk and you can go across the road and up the sidewalk. But when you're thinking about it, it seems like so hard to get it right to you.
I've got a great joke about centipede.
Go on. Oh, I'll go on, my mind. Yeah. But Wolf might want to hear it again.
I have a question for you. You know, several times you said, well, this doesn't necessarily rise to the phenomenal level, the kind of things you were talking about. But how often does it, and how important is it whether it does or doesn't, and how much do you work with that, or how much do you investigate that in your own experience?
I haven't, and I should. I think the only answer I could give was that it was partly, I think we kind of came to it earlier on, but it rises to the phenomenal level when something which catches my attention takes my attention. So the noise over here took my attention while I was speaking. I could hear movement here. And that took my attention. That rose to a level at which
it had
a qualitative.
So at that point you have a phenomenal experience. But in terms of the ideas that you're working out, you know, how often do you find in the course of those you say, yes, here's an experience I've had which confirms that or helps clarify it? That's my question.
I think that's a very difficult question, Jack. I really do. I think that, I've given all sorts of examples when I think it happens, but I don't think I don't have more than that to give you. So I think, I don't think I can answer that question.
So your answer is that it does happen sometimes, but it's not something you try to do systematically.
No, but perhaps I should. Perhaps I ought to think about that. Shall I put the first light up?
This is before the first light.
Oh,
Is
this pre-futing?
In a previous lifetime, I was a trumpet player, you know that. And I became interested in your experience. And then I took up the classical guitar 20 years ago or so, after I was pretty good at knowing about inner experience.
Are you going to ask me what Kant would say about descriptive something?
No, I'm not. I'm going to tell you something about the phenomenology of acquiring the skill of playing the classical guitar.
Okay.
Because there came a time after I was a moderately good classical guitarist that it became apparent that what I was doing was paying attention to what my fingers would be about to do, not what they were actually doing, but what they were about to do.
I agree.
And that lasted for a while.
Yep.
And it actually improved my level of guitar playing skill.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, it became clear that I was paying attention to what I was about to do.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, one notch before what I was about to do, what I was preparing to be about to do,
mm-hmm.
and my guitar playing skill improved while I was doing that as well. And then it became, and which is where I am right now, actually, that I'm not paying attention to either any of those things, and my guitar playing still has improved one more notch. So I don't know whether there's yet something beyond
skin,
that. But
skin is like that, too.
Yep.
When you're getting better, you're actually two or three turns ahead of the one you're actually doing.
Yep.
I think
as you get confidence, you just go to the band and it doesn't matter anymore.
Can I say that I've had very similar experiences with the difference between playing the piano and playing the saxophone. And I never got to the point, and I never have got to the point with the saxophone, where I'm really thinking about what's coming next, where the fingers are going to be the next positions. And I think that's one of those examples that has come to my mind where I thought, the big difference here is I'm not anticipating. And not enacting, and I've just never been any good at it. It's interesting now. I don't have a horse currently, but I had horses. I've had horses for most of my life, but now we live in the centre of Glasgow, and it's hard. They don't have anywhere to. They don't. It's tricky in a tenement. I know. Oh yes, of course. I need a Plymouth. Where was I going with that? I know. But it's funny. I do still watch horse riding on television. Not that often, because I find that, especially show jumping, I used to like one and 3 day eventing, because you've got to race around at great speed, and you've got to do wonderful dressage, which is like dancing on a horse. It's really beautiful, and you feel as though, if you get it right, you feel as though the centre of gravity is just, it's a marvellous feeling. I'm sure that it's, what's the phrase, being zen with your, anyway, so. But when I watch show jumping on television, my whole body is, and I'm checking the horse.
Mirror,
exactly. But I've noticed that it's, the arms are going, and I'm checking the horse, And when they don't get it right, it hurts. Mm. It's, so the whole of the mirror neurons are playing a great part, but the musculature is anyway.
I'm going to ask you.
That's enacting. That's the kind of thing I was coming to with that. It's a kind of enacting what I would expect to be happening.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you know nature, and I embody and soul aspects of travel, and sometimes we're all trained, but the wise enlightened man says, no, I embody entirely, nothing inside. Mm. And he goes on to give a kind of an active theory of the self. I want to come though to the question I asked you and said, come to that, haven't you? What happens when there's not a possibility of action anymore?
Yeah.
I mean, what isn't it? I think everything we're talking about is real. I mean, I recognize the agent we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's a very significant part of our sense of self. But I'm not sure it solves the problem of phenomenal consciousness.
Yeah.
Phenomenal consciousness seems to me most impressive in areas which we don't associate with muscular movement and so on. It is precisely its sound, its smell, its taste, its colour and so on.
I think what happens there is that we are thrown into ourselves. We talked briefly about paraplegics the other day.
Mm.
And I feel like the other day, but it was yesterday. I had lots going on. I sent you an article by Jonathan Cole, and Jonathan Cole talks about people with spinal cord injuries, and I might just have this slide here, and he says that, and I will come back to your point directly, he says of the top one, spinal cord injury, in the absence of direct afferent input and efferent feedback from the somatosensory motor cortex, the brain hallucinates input, and in the case where a chap called David, he talks about a chap who's had high thoracic injury. Is that the right phrase? High thoracic injury. Okay. And he is paralysed from the neck downwards, and he feels as though his head is floating around the room, and he feels disembodied, and he hallucinates his body, but he hallucinates his body by hallucinating pain. So he is thrown back on himself. He is imagining a sensory input, to imagine not being disembodied, to not being, he feels as if his head is floating around the room because it's not tied down. He hasn't got the weight. Probably hell, he's not even the weight of the body to anchor it to the ground.
So the hallucinated pain makes him feel that he's grounded in his body again, is that?
Yes, that's exactly right. For a little while, it's recorded in their article, super article, about phenomenology and imagination. It's in volume 4 of Phenomenology and Cognitive Sciences, and I think it's number 2.
Reference.
Oh, God, there it is. Thank you very much. Oh, volume 4. Number 2. I haven't got number 2 there, but I know it is. I can send it to you, don't worry, because I send it to you. But can we come back to your locked-in patient?
Well, here, back to
that. Oh, okay.
Do you know?
No.
It's called Butterfly and the Fabulous.
Oh, yes. Well, yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Yes, and what is so astonishing about that is that phenomenal consciousness and selfhood seems to be intact in someone who has only an eyelid to move with. And I don't want to go there, but in any case, I don't think you answered the question which, in general, which is what has bodily movement got to do with hearing music or seeing red or whatever it might be?
I think that seeing red, I don't know of anything to do with musculature in the auditory system, but I would imagine there must be muscles involved somehow. I know about the visual system, yes?
But didn't Nick say earlier that sensation is something we do?
Well, that's what I say, yes, but I wish Susan would say.
Okay, sensation is something you do. Yes, me on that. Okay.
Yes,
yes. Okay. I know you just plainly let me know. wonderful wonderful Alfred Hitchcock Presents from about 1955, and it's got Joseph Cotton in it. I'm sure we'll find it on the internet.
That's the one where he's killed.
No. Joseph Cotton is parallel. He's in a, it's a lovely story. He's and I'll be very quick about it. He's a manager of a large company, and he's on the first scene. He's telephoning, or there's a telephone call. He is telling, there's a man on the phone, one of his employees, who says, "Look, I really can't. You can't sack me. I don't want to lose this job. It's my livelihood. What am I going to do? I'm 50 something. I'm not going to get another job." And then the man starts to cry, and Joseph Cotton puts the phone down and says, "What a terrible thing, a grown man crying." And then he drives off in his car, and he's in a serious car accident, and his head is wedged against the steering wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And people come along, first of all, he's out in the country in California somewhere, and first of all people come along and they take the wheels off the car, or they take bits and pieces they can find from the car. And then a couple of escaped convicts come along. They don't check to see if he's alive, they think he's dead. Then a couple of escaped convicts come along. One of them seems to be a little bit kinder than the other, a bit more compassionate than the other one, and he has a little look at him. They don't do the mirror test to see if he's breathing or anything like that. But he's completely paralyzed, not even eyelid movement. They take his wallet, they take some of his clothes, and they head off. And eventually, he's taken to a rescue team comes, and he's taken to a morgue, and they put the sheet over him. And then the mortician says, "I'll come back tomorrow morning and I'll see what I can do."
It's not like a really fun movie, all that.
You get the popcorn, you get the coke, everything. Well, the next day the mortician comes in and he's going to have a last look at him. And Joseph Cotton's character is just lying there. And all the time, the only thing you can hear is his thoughts. And he's saying, they don't even know. It's locked in there. They don't know that I'm alive. They can't. And then a tear comes out. And it's the only way he's got to communicate. Aww. There's a grown man crying. Oh, wow. It is such a sentiment. I don't know enough about locked in syndrome.
Break. Can you take a 7 minute break and then go on?
What's it? I've forgotten to with what comes next.
Actually, I don't know between the two of you. Okay. What about to come next?
So,
And then Mate. And then, so we have three presentations this afternoon. And then dinner. And then me.
What, after dinner?
There's an experiential session which I would be doing. Sort of a combination presentation experiential session. It's meant to be experiential.
What did I commit myself to? Sensations or...
Actions.
But how do you
explain?
No,
I don't disagree with that. That's
okay.
I would like to sit on a chair.
So you don't fancy that?
You know what? No, it's.
Okay. So now this is going. And this is going.
So it is recording or
it's recording, but it has to have a pause. Wait a minute. It's not seeming to want to unpause. It is recording, yes.
It's recording?
But it's not.
But this guy doesn't work.
Yeah. That means you're
learning. And it's recording,
yeah.
Fantastic. Just pause it. Just pause it here. Great.
Right.
That's it.
Okay. But you're going to want to also be ready to start the real player.
It's ready. It's ready.
Okay,
it's
let me just put it.
So,
yeah.
Okay. I think.
So our next scheduled presentation is by your mother.
Yes.
Yes.
What was your mother? What was that?
Yeah.
We're getting
my people. I am not here.
I'm thinking about it.
John, you can get the more comfortable seat now. So I'm going to wait for Pradeep and suppose that we have a call.
She's on the phone, so we'll wait for her.
Okay.
I'm sure she'll be in there soon. Pradeep is on his way. Pradeep is on his way.
Okay. So I remember a couple of years ago I've been to UCLA listening to Castaneda, and I remember now when I was preparing for this, he was having one phrase that he kept repeating all the time, and it was, "Don't complain, don't explain." That was his like motto. And actually, I'm just going to do both of this stuff. First, I'm going to be explaining and apologizing, and then I'm going to be complaining about the state of the things. First, well, apologizing. I'm not prepared for this. I actually was extremely busy before I came to space, and I was expecting it to be just a dialogical session that I really like, this kind of stuff. Actually, this is almost the only kind of meeting I'm going to recently. So I thought, oh great, I'm just going to get fired from the action and we're going to discuss it. And I also thought, this is the stuff I am working on for years now, and it should not be a problem to say something about it. But I even enforced this feeling when we started, when we had this presentation. I said, well, yeah, there are some people to be enlightened here. I have to do my mission. But now I became so modest and not so, at least I noticed that I should be much more modest. I feel so grateful to Jack for this invitation and for this opportunity that we are here. So I will try to do one of other things. I'm not sure I'm going to be successful at this, but I would like to at least a little bit present my view of first-person investigation, inquiry, perhaps science, perhaps not. But I would like to do it in connection with what was already said here. And if there is any chance that you might find any of this challenging, I would like as much discussion to pull back and let us at least half an hour of space for discussion about this. I would really like for us to go to the center of it. So by that meaning, question, can there be first person science and how should it look like if? So I am granting all my time for this. I'm just going to do some of my propositions and some mostly my questions about it. And I actually, when I was writing my bio, my little contribution for our internet forum, I was actually presupposing that everybody here being master of first-person investigation, that there is no point me like defending the need of it, or there is no point that I go into epistemological or methodological explanation of why it's really important that we consider idea of first person investigation and why it is really strange or questionable or improper to use classical scientific paradigm for this kind of phenomena. But now I still decided I'm going to at least mention how I got towards it. But before I go into this, it's probably very obvious, but still I would like to say that I am very much in doubt of everything. I'm questioning it all the time, and I feel my basic education is mathematical physics. So that's why I have this feeling that I can afford being vague and waving with hands a lot, not just because I can't speak English very well, but mostly because I do have some solid, hard methodological background, so I can also afford to balance it with this. And I was talking to you before and explaining how actually I do miss this hard data, hard, very easy procedures, methodologically straight stuff, and how problematic it is for me to be in this vague area, although everything tells me that I should be here and that's the thing we should be doing right now. So I'm also gonna abuse some of the poetry. The first is Tukaram, not very well known, but for Indians, I guess, very well known mystical poet from India. I totally love him. I really love him. And I would really ask somebody, some British, so it will sound more intelligent speaking person, or perhaps Jack, you're the closest, if you can read it, because I'm going to do too much of the violence, so if I
read it. I was meditating with my cat the other day, and all of a sudden she shouted, "What happened?" I knew exactly what she meant, but encouraged her to say more, feeling that if she got it all out on the table, she would sleep better that night. So I responded, "Tell me more, dear." And she soulfully meowed, "Well, I was mingled with the sky. I was comets whizzing here and there. I was suns in heat. Hell, I was galaxies. But now, look, I am landlocked in fur." And this I said, "I know exactly what you mean. What to say about conversation between mystics?"
So you see, it's terrible. It's also a little bit, I found it, I said, oh, let's go to Nick's account, because he says, "I know exactly what you mean." Well, so this explains my problem quite well. But still, let me try give you a sort of a draft of where I would like to go, how I would like to lead you to my understanding of first-person investigation. So this first part was not intended at all. I thought we all agree in this, and there is no point going there. But still, I would like to mention a little bit why I think standard scientific approach or paradigm or however we call it, nomothetic science or naturalistic or positivistic or other, why it's questionable to use this kind of paradigm in investigating some area of phenomena. And by that I will mostly go into first-person phenomena, that is experience. And then I would like to, the other part will be explanation of how I perceive first-person science. And there is big question mark. I don't want to claim that first-person science is possible. I think it's sensible to think about this option, but even more important it is that we are really strict, epistemologically strict, and if we decide, don't mean just us, but if it's decided that it is not possible, let's call it differently. I don't think this agenda should be abandoned, this line of work should be abandoned. I can't imagine this to be an option, but I do believe that this is a big question, whether we should call it a science or not. So, in this department, I'd like to investigate what are the goals or motives for doing it. Existentially important, another big question mark, where I really hope you're going to help me a little bit with the wording. I'll go into this later. Then the method, which is in big quotation rate. It's really, again, the method is no method. There are two just directions that I want to point. One is learning how to see, I call it that way. And the other is sticking with the question, which is really very much in line with what Wendell was saying yesterday. And then I would like to just touch the idea of community of first-person researchers, which will also, in this department, I'm going to go into the question of intersubjectivity. Normally, I do it the first half. I do it explain how I feel it's about intersubjectivity in first-person investigation, but I decided for that because I'm going to try this new building approach, and I know that Matthew is going to go into this, so I can like open the door for him. I would also like, I just put it right now, to talk now or later about the education, because I was really thrilled that John was mentioning this, and we somehow decided that it would be great to gather a group of people that are interested in this, perhaps not now, but somewhere in the course of next days. I have a course in my faculty called, I'm not going to translate the name, but it's about first-person investigation, and I have huge troubles leading it, so any help could be really helpful there. So that's the plan. I'm going to do this now, because I don't want this to disturb us. So there are many indices that we do need some other scientific paradigm, or it's hard not to be grandiose. Paradigm is so a loaded word and so misused, but here I really can't find any other term. To research some sort of phenomenon that are eluding what we are doing, what the science is doing right now. And I had one path leading me to this knowledge or to this recognition, but I also noticed now going around, the different people had totally different arguments for it, but somehow we meet at that this rattling point. So my path was, as I said, I was a physicist, but I was immediately very much in cognitive science and doing the neural networks. And then I really was frustrated. I thought doing intelligence system is really, I was very much influenced with Vinograd and Flores. Intelligence systems, how can we do intelligence systems if we cannot do a live system? Then Varela came here, and so can we do autopoietic systems? For example, can we model them? Can we program them? Here I was very much influenced with what Santa Fe Institute is doing and so on. But I was totally unsatisfied. I found out that something essentially is missing, and somehow I also at the same time was studying, I was fascinated by cybernetics, and by that way I came to California, to Watsley, to MRI. more and more I was into this constructivist frame of mind, which was, and it became quite obvious for me that something is wrong epistemologically, not just that the methods are not correct. So there are many, many ways how to get here. One of them is I sometimes ask students, postgraduate students, why do you think, I'm lecturing the Faculty of Education, why do you think we have such problems with methodology? Why do you think it's really hard to get some valid, sound methodology for research of our phenomena, which is like education research, dialogue stuff, community or group dynamics and this kind of stuff. And we all probably know that how the methodology developed, how we at first we really tried to imitate the hard scientific approach, but we have to admit more and more that it's impossible and some different ways of approach are adopted and so on. And they are normally there are three answers to this question. The first answer is complexity. This is epistemologically not problematic answer. It's just that we are the phenomena we are researching here is so much complex, so very.
Can you just drop?
Yeah, drop in whenever.
When you go asking the comment on the problems in investigating first-person phenomena, but what give an example of something which we want to investigate and which we have problems with? An example, rather than to say first person.
Oh yeah, I didn't even come to first person yet. I'm telling that there is this growing unease with the methodology in social science, in humanities, and so on. I just want to put first person at the end of it.
But some concrete example.
For example, we have the Faculty of Education methods of teaching. How to investigate which, for example, people would like to do, which method is better. And it shows to be virtually totally impossible. There can be statistical research, whatever, but it shows that it has no validity at all. That it just shows, I mean, probably we all know the fidelity phenomenon, what was the name of the, I'm really lousy with names.
Ofo?
No. The German psychologist who tried to research how, which method of psychotherapy is the best.
It's been done in Britain. They're all bad.
Completely wrong. They're all good.
Yes.
For example,
with teaching methods, if I want to assess whether a particular method of teaching reading,
yeah, why would you
do another one? Why is that in principle such a difficult thing to do? And in fact,
I just want to say why in principle, but in practice. It shows just which method the investigator likes, for example. And then more you try to be objective, less you get out of it.
Why?
Well, for example, what can you do?
Two classes of children.
Yeah, that's one
by one method and one by the other.
Yeah. It just shows where the teacher is really enthusiastic. And the other, then they say, oh, this method is much better, and they put it, they say, to some teachers, you have to use this method, they say, and it becomes really unuseful.
No, but you couldn't control for those effects.
Mm-hmm. It's very common. I mean, is it a problem? We can stop here. That's one of the things I was dealing with for many years, and now I'm just like saying that it's like totally obvious that it's a problem, but that there's so much, and I mean, that the whole area of qualitative research was actually developed because of impotence of this kind of research, actually. Don't you think so?
No. I mean, I think there are areas which are very difficult to investigate, but I'm wondering what's in your mind when you're talking about them. I think the example you've just given of assessing teaching methods is not in the classroom. I think standard methods of controlled research are just about right.
Why then don't we have the best teaching method?
Well, that's because of politics. Well, we somebody said that the government's always asking what's the scientific answer. That's the last thing. They know the answer.
For example, I think this is also true, of course, but mainly it cannot be established because it is biological stuff. This is the, I'm going to get into this right now, but Johnny wants to say
something. I totally disagree with Nick, but I suppose I want to hear more of what you've got to say. But then you said you prefer to be in dialogue. I don't know quite where to go because I think we can show that you are right about how you can't do research to show which method of pedagogy is the best because there isn't one. Just as there isn't the best style of cooking.
There is something which is constantly
culturally negotiated. Mm-hmm. And you can't say this. You can't say to teachers, look, science shows that method A is better than method B. And if I'm a teacher and you tell me that, and that I've got to use method B, but actually I like method A, that's what I'm good at, that scientific research is irrelevant to me as a teacher. And that's why I think...
My point is that I'm going to get exactly into this. So I just wanted to say, I guess we agree that there is a big unease in this area of research. I'm not even going to claim that it's impossible or whatever, but there are lots of books right now coming up trying to divide new methods, like grounded theorist, action research. But let's read it. I just wanted to say that there are like three answers. And one is, for example, your answer probably, complexity. It's much more complex, but it can be done. And there is another answer to this issue, which would be, I call it Goethe's answer. Goethe has this little poem, I don't have it in English, which speaks about how if you want to study the living, you have to kill first. I don't know if you know it, it's a really nice mm-hmm. poem. I have it in German and in Slovene, but not in English, so doesn't matter. But he is the first guy I know in this modern history that mentioned this. So we could say irreducibility of phenomena, so that's why we can study. And there is a third answer, which is participation. Meaning that we are actually participating in what we are researching and influencing each other. And this stuff, this was really nicely shown with Ranulf Glanville's black box, white box example. Are you familiar? This is like a classic reading in cybernetics. I can just draw it a little bit. He's using the black box metaphor. This is by, I think, Maxwell, the person to use this metaphor, which is a metaphor for something we try to know, but we intrinsically, by default, we cannot know what is in there. So we have to observe it. This is like the...
The inputs and outputs. You have no idea what the process is.
That's a black box metaphor, and Glanville is using it like that. He says, okay, this is the black box. So blackness is a symbol of, you cannot go into this. You cannot, Einstein's clock, for example. So the only thing you can know about it is its inputs and outputs. So let's say these are inputs and outputs. And me being observer, and Glanville, if you ask me wrongly, so presupposes that observer knows him or herself biblically, as he writes, which is probably connected with this.
But
let's not go in there. So there is observer.
Literally or metaphorically?
Sorry?
Literally or metaphorically?
Yeah, but we'll talk about that mm-hmm. all the rest of the time. So. For example, let's leave it why. So, and then observer observes outputs and inputs of the black box and tries to model them and make some functional relationships. And by that, And when this functional relationship is established, he says, he or she says, I know this. And to do this, there must be some circular checking. So it's really good, especially in science, that we actually reverse this. And that was totally wrong. I'm sorry. The error should be like that. Outputs and inputs go into the observer. But if you really want to do the real science, you have to be able to change inputs. And by that, check your model, your functional relationship. So it goes like that. So we have a circular relationship. And, I mean, it's a pretty long paper somewhere. Glenn will conclude that actually there is no essential difference between observer and observed. And even, I mean, what is really important for us here is that actually knowing something is actually just gaining stability in this circular relationship. When we get stabilities, so when one of my inputs produces reaction that I expect, then we know the stuff. But it also shows very well how observer and observed is totally interconnected. And then Glanville, in some other papers, somehow shows that there are different levels of possible stabilities. Our physical world enables us total stability, and we can really count on knowing things around. And, of course, what is on the other part of the scale? It's our consciousness. This is really actually hard to research or observation of consciousness. It's really hard to draw it like that, because it's one thing. Both of these figures are one thing here. And then he also goes into other levels. For example, that I know, if I suppose that I know one phenomenon, then going to the second order, trying to see what I know, makes another, you know, this is like the blackboard, this becomes the black box, and then we have another circle of the higher order, and which makes another problem, because this is again totally a black box, and we have to gain stability as well. So, but the whole point I wanted to show with this example is that we are interconnected, and from cybernetic of the second order point of view, it's like that with everything we observe.
Well, can I interrupt again? I mean, you can make it sound rather mysterious and special, and you know,
right,
we've got a problem here. But let's take a particular case. Somebody wants to investigate, let's say, the phenomenon of choice blindness, which is the one I talked about yesterday. In practice, they have no choice blindness. We talked about. Right. I want to explain again, though.
Right.
But in practice, they set up the experiment. They test subjects, and they can have totally predictable outcomes with modeling the behavior of a human being in a very surprising way.
So they gain the stability in this.
Yeah. But this is studying consciousness at the very basic level. I mean, somebody's inability to make first-person reports about their reasons for acting. In practice, in that case, it doesn't turn out to be such a problem. So I think, you know, say, because in principle we've got this loopiness.
Yeah.
This is, you know, we're
I absolutely agree with you. And I would really, I thought I somehow explained this when I started, when I said I'm actually torn apart between first and third. If we can do this, we should definitely, I mean, that's almost a claim, we should definitely stick with the third person methods. Definitely. If, I'm going to get to this in a little bit, in a while. But if we can do it in third person, it's fantastic. That would be really, I would be really misunderstood if I would be understood that I want to forget about the third person method in study of consciousness and just concentrate the first person. Not at all. I would be really unhappy. I actually work in two areas, two scientific areas. One is first person investigation, and the other is cognitive science. I'm president of Slovenia Society of Cognitive Science, and what I really try to do is get people together, get neurologists and philosophers together, and AI people and so on. And I'm totally fascinated by what they do, and anthropologists and so on. So, of course, if that works, we should stick with it hard. So I totally agree with that. But I guess you agree with me that there are some cases where it's not so easy, where it doesn't work so well. And I would just like to warn that we should not take it for granted that it is possible to do it wherever and whenever, with whatever phenomenon. Saying this, somehow there is sort of a path to this problem, but there are so many different ways to showing that it is really dubious in some areas that we should use the third-person method. For example, you were actually explaining how lonely and how we are in the area of consciousness, and how we, I mean, old knowledge, how there is no way to know what somebody else thinks or feels or so on. I'm not going to go into it if that is true or not, but definitely if we believe this, then it's really the only way that we study that I study my consciousness. That's my view of it. And that sort of phenomenological perspective that I think is something that we should take into account in our business. There are other epistemological issues here. For example, all the standard science is based on the idea of objective world out there. And I have huge problems with us explaining or thinking of most of cognitive phenomena in that terms. So I have, for example, I was explaining to you, I have this problem thinking of, for example, pre-reflective stuff or whatever is part of the experience as think they are there, which is like very objectivistic. Things are there, we just have to somehow discover them. This puts us to some higher perspective, some view of from nowhere or however you want to put it, and I don't think this is epistemologically sound. At least we should be really careful what we are saying. Perhaps sometimes it is, but we should really be, and for example, Susan, I also have problems with this saying that, just mixing, saying, oh, these are mirror neurons, and this probably is, I know a lot about rats, so I can speak about it. You know, just mixing very different epistemological levels into one argument. That is probably also the problem. So,
it's an objection that Noe and Thompson have to a lot of the work on neurology and neurophysiology.
Mm-hmm.
That there's not enough distinction or differentiation between the personal and the subpersonal levels.
Yeah, I work a lot with neuroscientists, and they have no feeling of this at all. They just mix everything. They start with saying we're going to study neurological correlates of whatever phenomena, but then they mix everything together. That doesn't matter. It's like, yes, I feel this because of my neurons, or this is all me. I would really be very cautious in this. So, I don't know. Obviously, I didn't show well that it's really important to do the first-person science, but...
Fine.
Am I?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I disagree with something Nick said about the choice blind thing, choice blindness, because you said that's access to first-person consciousness, but it's access to a narrative, a post-hoc explanation. It's not access to the first-person consciousness, but we shouldn't go there. We can come back.
Okay.
Let's come back, because it's unfair.
It seems to me you can predict what someone will report about their first-person experience. That's
perfect. Yeah. If you can, that's it.
That's what the experiment does.
But Nick, I don't think that experiment is complete, because there were 80% who reported who were choice blind, but 20% weren't. So there's some difference between the two. And if you take those 18 and use Claire's methods on them, you know, ask them to, or train them to look at their pre-choice phenomenology or whatever it is. And suppose from those 80%, 60% were able, when you did the experiment again, now did not, were not choice blind, then you show that the first person science is having an effect.
Well, I mean, that's what they do. They debrief them afterwards with a very sensitive interview, trying to see exactly whether actually they've detected anything, and if so, what. And so. I mean, it seems to me it's an example of good science using the combination of first-person, third-person methods. I think this distinction is not a terribly helpful one. I mean, the data, what we're trying to model are first-person statements. You have to be imaginative, and you have to be think of all the possible pitfalls and so on. But that sort of research is by no means impossible. And I think by kind of continuing hopping on about we've got to go to a first person level and tackle this phenomenon which no one else can deal with and so on. We're setting ourselves up, you know, as somehow in a superior level of doing psychological science and dealing with phenomena which are over and above which all, you know, the nerds down there can deal with. And I think that's a good idea. I think, you know, we are scientists. We're interested in a particular kind of phenomenon, but we're not a different class of scientists to cognitive scientists or whatever it may be.
Well, I disagree with that. I think we are absolutely different. Not the first person scientists should be absolutely different class of scientists than the others. And I also disagree with, as much as I really love Varela, I disagree with his attempts to join phenomenology and neurology or neuroscience together. But from Forrester, my big hero from across the bay, he said, he called this phenomena where we somehow have to admit or we somehow notice that we are so much into the system, that we are so much affecting what is researched and this research affects us, that we cannot get a stable interaction here, but we are constructing each other all the time. He called this kind of phenomena non-trivial. And he said, well, there are three ways how to deal with the non-trivial systems or phenomena. One is, and this is the most popular, to ignore it. Fantastic, works many times. The other is to try to violently trivialize whatever we are doing. So we know this is happening all the time in social science, as I see it. We know that we do influence whatever we are researching, but we try to be objective as possible, as objective as possible, and so on, and we go on with research. And the third possible way out, as from first saw it, he told it to develop the epistemology of non-triviality. That's how he said it. But I think he would be totally happy with saying to develop the first-person inquiry or science of first-person inquiry. So I will go with that. And I would just like now that go to the second part of it and just propose how it would look like in my eye. And it's pretty radical idea. I will try to build it up. So just give me a little bit of
slack
rope, and I'm gonna hang myself in like 15 minutes. First, what is the motive of the science in general, or what is the goal of science? I can see two. One is, I don't know which one to say first. One is to see, to know, to understand. So, being really curious about something. That's, I guess we all agree this is one of the motives. And the other is that something is bugging me, I want to change it. I was brought up in socialistic country and I was mostly taught about this other. He said, ah, people were really unhappy and then they invented wheel. First step towards the happy future. And then they were cold and then they invented fire. But now, since I'm thinking of it, I can much more see some really introspective guy that is really lousy in hunting elephants or whatever, and sitting there and seeing some rock falling, and you know, just wondering about it, not being very much into practical issues. But these are two motives that normally drive us to go into research. And in this area, I think the first person science doesn't differ at all from third person science. I think, and now I'm going to use a really loaded term, I think we all want to know what is true. And my constructivist friend would just kill me right now on the spot if heard me telling this. It's really a forbidden term there, and I somehow agree with it, but now, since I've done a little bit of first-person investigation, I was checking it and said, yeah, I just wanted to know what's really there, what's really going on. Not there, but what's really going on. That's the motive. Just the truth is of different kind here. There is something totally different about the truth than analytical philosophy or epistemology. Modern term would go into. And this is connected to knowledge, of course. And I think this is the biggest difference. This is the biggest difference where first person, third person science are like going to. That's why I think we are pretty much different. If we check what kind of knowledge we need. For example, I didn't read Sue Blackmore's book that's interviews. We are translating it right now to Slovenian, and I really had to get it. I hope there is some of it there. But I mean, if one talks to different people from cognitive science, which I do, from different areas, they have totally different ideas what cognitive science should research. Totally different. For example, AI people are becoming more and more modest, and neuroscience are becoming more and more
machine consciousness.
Yeah, so very different. Yeah. But at the end, everybody would agree in saying to understand consciousness more. That's pretty much common ground. But what does it mean understand? And now we get to this your question actually. In third-person science, to understand means to know how it works, to be able to explain it, to be able to build some sort of model, to be able to predict that. That's like the high peak of it. If we are able to predict, that's the best. That's pretty much what understand means in third-person science. And now, checking within myself, I'm asking myself, what would it mean in first-person science? For example, in science of consciousness. Is it for me really important that I can explain propositionally some stuff that about my consciousness? Is this really what I'm looking for? And my answer is many times no, not always. So, Matej and I were having 2 years ago, I think, a lecture in Zagreb, and we developed this this two-step scheme of how we arrived to this first question was, can we use the already existing methodological third-person techniques to study whatever we are interested in? So if the answer is yes, that's great. For example, if you think that that phenomenon you are describing can be, or if you have data, it can be researched in third-person science, go with it. That's great, fantastic. As much as possible. But the second fork, the second decision point is the question, are we satisfied with the results? Are the results we are getting things that we are expecting from it, actually? I mean, or things that really somehow satisfies my curiosity? For example, if I don't know, I have some problem or whatever, would I be really satisfied to know that 80% of people are responding to this that way? I wouldn't. So, in many cases, again, this is like two questions we have to ask ourselves, and if both is answer no, then I think we are in area of first-person science.
Can I hold you up again on that? So you're saying that if we could do, meet all the criteria you put forward in first-person scientific explanation, and let's put in the question is, let's say a basic one, like what is, you know, how does brain activity yield conscious experience? Okay. Supposing we have an answer at the level which is totally satisfying, we can predict and exceed transparently why this activity in the brain will lead to these phenomena, and all the first person reports and everything which go with it. You're saying, well, okay, but I might still not might be satisfied by that. And I think you're right. You might not be. Thomas Messenger.
Not really.
Messenger says, well, we might have the answer, but the question is it an intelligible answer? And I've quoted before him the same point. Persing writes in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. He says, the truth comes knocking at the door. You say, go away, I'm looking for the truth. And so it goes away. If we get to the truth, which is what you said you wanted, and can't recognize it, that's not a failure of our science. It's a failure of, at some other level, isn't it? It's a failure in terms of our motivation, or not a failure, but it's basically saying we didn't want to do science.
Yeah, we have different motivation, exactly. Yeah. And what is our
motivation? Isn't that splitting science up
from itself? I mean, doesn't science involve both, you know, the finding out and the epistemology to know when you found out?
Well, if you can do all the things which Evan says, you know, is what, you know, traditionally thought science tried to do, and we find we can do that in relation to consciousness, I'm not saying we're anywhere near to doing that, but supposing we could. And if people say, yes, but that's not what I really wanted, which I think is what they will say, I don't think we will recognize the answer when we've got it, or certainly won't satisfy people. I don't think that shows that we need another kind of science. It shows that we, you know, we need to...
That our questions are wrong, or our motives are wrong.
Isn't the question really what the motivation is and what people want? And I don't mean what people want in terms of their delusions of what they think they want. I mean, we may all want to, you know, walk on water or something like that. I'm not trying to deal with that. But I think there is something motivational here, which is not just about answering truth, but it is some deep suspicion that the nature of the truth that the first person science will answer misses something essential about whatever they think their first person experience is, what they think is possible through their intuitions or revelations of a first person experience. That sense that perhaps the scientific method is actually addressing some truths, but it's missing out.
If you said they're just not going to be satisfied with the results of a first-person science, well, I think that's right. I don't think first-person science delivers different kinds of truths from third-person science. I think the problem you're addressing is science. Do we want scientific answers at all?
Not at all. I'm addressing the problem is I am starting from the curiosity, which is one of the sound points where to start. So I'm curious. I want to know about some phenomena. And for example, if I'm curious about how some neuron cells deliver this and this output and this happens, then of course I should be satisfied with the model. How they do it, or even if I can measure this and produce some repeatable result, great. But sometimes I am interested, and in this very intimate sphere of consciousness, I'm much more interested in some other stuff. Me, perhaps not, you know. And can I just play a little bit there with your eyes? I asked you that already. Can I?
Yeah, okay.
Or not?
If I can say something about that afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's really not so. Okay.
This is Claire. You heard that already? And she will explain this much more, with much nicer accent than I do. So, I guess.
Les méthodes d'accès à la conscience, d'essayer de montrer à la communauté scientifique que ces méthodes sont fiables, reliable, makes us unreliable results. What's the goal? In fact, personally, I don't care. I don't care. But my goal is to, because I think that the scientific community has un grand poids. They have much influence in the long term of our lives, on the way we live, and
a great influence.
Yeah. And I try to just to call the attention on this level of consciousness. But the goal is to transform the experience. For me, the main goal is to become able to transform our experience, epileptic experience, or our experience as living humans. And the scientific is just
a detour.
Yes.
No, Jack says it's over. did you want to say? Thank you very much. I mean, I totally liked it. I was totally ecstatic when you were saying this, because actually you explained what I wanted to say without me. Thank you.
Can you put it in your own words now?
I don't think so, actually. I am interested in different, many times, in different area of things, and the knowledge here is not, the knowledge that satisfies my curiosity or my wish to change things is not propositional one. This is what I want to say. I want to, for example, when I do first-person research, the phenomena I research are about my intimate feelings or view of consciousness, and they are not, I could not benefit much by knowing how neurons are producing this or how I am, I don't know, in this third-person result. So this is a huge question whether this is a scientific area of experience, but there is curiosity. There is something that can be researched, and it can be researched systematically. This obviously Claire and Ross and some others show that it can be researched systematically. So,
but what they also are doing is doing something quite within the traditional paradigm.
Exactly. I would like to address this now. Exactly. So the question is, can we make the science that is not detour, but is addressing the first Claire's question, or Wendell's question, ambiguity between doing the science and trying to get enlightened?
The motivations toward self-transformation versus
exactly.
toward revealing scientific truth.
That's exactly what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Would it be accurate to call it first-person technology that you're looking for?
No, not at all. But that's the worst possible naming. Because it's technology is about a process. And here, I think we will shortly discover that the method or algorithm or recipe is impossible.
But first question,
and there is this big, big issue. If there is no curiosity, if there is only wish to transform, it cannot be science at all. There must be both. This is really important.
It's also the ambiguity of even transformative processes. Because people who get involved in transformation on the level of a truthful transformation in the sense that the truth sets you free. So if you have the accurate scientific understanding, you may not get too caught up in delusional forms of self-transformation. So you get this subtle tension that goes on.
I don't think so.
In the end,
no.
The tension is also that people, well, I may be not using tension in the same way as you're saying it, but I think the issue is that for some people you also get to the stage that what you're trying to understand is also not how to be different, but why you are the way you are, which brings it again back to the scientific description of it.
Yeah,
so there's this very, very subtle dynamic going on between seeing what is or recognizing the truth,
especially for Western trained
nature
person.
Of the truth.
Exactly.
And at the same time, as if you're caught up in transformation, you may also override what is true in terms of your transformational motivation.
And I think I'm not going to do justice to what you just said, so I hope people heard it, because I'm not really going to respond to it. Because I want to respond to what Urban said before and bring it back into focus with Walt's presentation yesterday. I said, and I think a couple of other people said, there was something there that I felt uncomfortable with. And I think Urban just said it very well. That if you're only interested in self-transformation without the impulse to know, which seems to me to be what underlies science, then that is also incomplete.
Cannot be. I mean, this is a huge question whether this can be a scientific endeavor. But if there is no, at least a little bit of the space to just to allow it, not to transform it, whatever you are looking at, then forget it in scientific terms. That's where I'm starting. But before that, I'm going to get back to this, and I'm going to speed up a little bit. I thought it's going to be lasting 20 minutes now. I'm taking Matthias' time. So I would just like to make three important points and then just hang myself. Sorry?
That's exactly what
No, metaphorically.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Just theoretically, no. Sorry. So we are getting to this existential importance. I want to just address the issue how the knowledge should look like in first person. So if we are not satisfied with propositional knowledge, I was trying to find the good name for it. I first called it dispositional, but then I saw that it's divided and it's loaded in some terms. So tacit is also not good. Knowledge how is, but it's just not propositional. It's something different, and I think it's in a different epistemological level. Not just, not this, but that part of the line, but it's on different epistemological level. And let me just try to explain how, with example, what I mean with this knowledge. For example, I was a couple of years ago, I had this talk, discussions in Asilo Mar, down there by Monterey, and I was flying towards to San Francisco, and then I rented a car, and it was like, I was awake for like 30 hours already, and I was driving down to Asilo Mar. And I was driving, and I was really sleepy.
Oh.
And I was thinking, this is not such a good idea that I'm sleepy. It's really not such a good idea. I must just doze off, and and I did. But the point is, this is propositional.
You stop the car first.
No, I didn't. I was just thinking that this is probably metacognition, I guess. But let's not go into this. But
you dozed off at the wheel.
Yeah, I did. It was a very interesting experience.
Cool.
But I survived.
Sorry?
When
Russell beat you.
Where were you? No, Russ, when you need one.
Where were you on the 7?
A couple of miles, no, like 20 miles before Monterey. It was an interesting history. I'm not going to go into it. I dozed off, and then from far away, I said, well, it's so nice here, but it's something strange here. And then I woke up and I was
two lanes left, but no cars. But I wanted to focus on the state before that. I was thinking, this is really not such a good idea that I'm driving and I'm so sleepy. But it was just propositional knowledge. It had no action power, to say that. But perhaps the better example is, I would
that's
like to
like
go...
It wasn't prescriptive.
Sorry?
It was just factual.
No, it's not prescriptive. I should really stop. That was also probably...
It
was
body.
It was not on this deep level, which I want to address right now. And perhaps a better example is what you gave with your speech, the death. Awareness of imminent death. There are these three levels. First is we are mortal beings. That's a fact. Me, from the perspective from nowhere, I can know this. Aristotle can do his syllogisms with it, whatever. That's it. Fact, we know it, it's empirical. But the other stuff is I know, I am mortal being, but it's still doesn't do anything. I just know it, I can philosophize with it a lot, I can whatever, play with it, but that's the other, that's the propositional knowledge. And there's this third, that for example, person that you were describing, God, that he knew I'm gonna die on some other level. And this is the level where first person science should operate.
But what would you call it?
I don't know. I thought in English there is this nice word realizing, probably totally wrong, but realizing is why. Matej told me that Krishnamurti once said that knowing is acting. Is that so? That's exactly what I mean.
Yeah. I would be careful.
When it is acting, seeing is acting. Okay, sorry. Okay,
but
and that's what I mean.
But realizing can be realizing in the sense of instantiating.
Right.
So you can realize a system.
Yeah, probably not a good one, but I like it because it's like, you know, it has also this I realize this.
Yeah.
I realize it.
Yeah.
And this is different. I read a book of the person with a similar experience who was diagnosed mortal disease, and then very soon, they found out that he's not ill at all. And he said it was the worst part of the whole process. I didn't read it. I was told about it, so I don't know exactly. But knowing that this feeling of, you know, being here and now, that was produced by this closeness of death is going away. He said, "I'm going back to this hell of automatical living." That was the worst part. So. This is the kind of knowledge I'm talking about.
Can I just add something about that experience, and then I want to push you a little bit more, the word. Something that he said about this just before the experience that I described, that I didn't mention yesterday, was that part of it was that he was now back, he was going to live, and he was probably not going to be able to practice as an emergency doctor anymore. And so part of what he was thinking about at that point was that kind of realizing that he had no purpose in life except to live, and he was kind of walking along getting that and feeling how kind of wonderful it was when lightning struck, you know, because it was very difficult for a pretty highly motivated, professionally dedicated scientist doctor who had been that way all his life, to be just kind of out there in space as
in space. That's a great. Yeah. That's the word I use with my students. Being like, this is a different. This is being in space.
Yeah.
You float. You're not direct. Again, to go back to Castaneda. Castaneda was saying we have a predator's eye all the time, which is like, and now you just switch it off for a while. So this is, I mean, I could talk a lot about it. I could also say some things, but let's move on. I suggest.
Before we do
that,
I'd just like to play journalist here. I'd just like to push you a bit for the word.
Oh, I thought that was it.
No, I mean, you know, if you can't come up with one, that's okay. We'll settle for
you. You mentioned Krishnamurti, and I'm going to go a little further with that. Because Krishnamurti, he used the phrase often perceptual knowledge. the perception meant something for him a little bit different than I think how we often use it in the sciences here. What he meant is when you see something, when you see the truth of something,
but that
you
truth.
Are transformed by that truth. You cannot live other than mm-hmm. the truth, than by that truth. But there was also something within Krishnamurti that was, that perception was almost a negative thing, in the sense that we are living in a world of confused concepts about who we are and how we perceive. So the act of perceiving the truth, or the truth of something, was transformative because the falsehood that our behavior was caught up in fell away. We defused and we lost that. So I'm not saying that that's the right term for us, but I'm saying that that is, that, you know, in his language, it perceptual knowledge sort of captured it, that he had a much more dynamic sense of what perception meant.
I think it's a very nice analogy. You could use something like, do you know the, I'm sure everybody knows these so-called hidden figures, where you see something that just looks like blotches on the page, and you can look and look and look and you can't see it, and then the structure is revealed. It's the head of Jesus or Mary or whatever it may be. Show that to somebody once, and experimental psychologists have shown that 30 years later, somebody would fix straight in. Yeah, they did. You can't forget. You can't see it otherwise. Once you've found that way of parsing the information in front of you. And that is a very interesting form of knowledge, actually, and, which is not propositional, for sure.
Yeah, when you were talking about that, I get this third person, my knowledge about consciousness, about, I don't know, Pribram's idea of holographic brain and how the potential structure, potential landscape forms, but I would not go here. I would just perhaps continue, because I would like to wrap it up. I think my time is up already.
Yeah, it would be good to wrap it up.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, I just started actually. But I will wrap it up in 5 minutes.
No, it's very, very helpful, very fruitful, but
yeah,
good to wrap it up.
Yeah. So, two more poems. Jack, could you read it? It's apropos of this.
To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes, to let it go. To let it go.
This is just a part of a poem. Mary Oliver, my favorite poem by her. So that was the first part. This is, I wanted to put in discussion. I will bother with this later. How to call this? I call it in one paper existential liability. This. To know that you're alive, this knowing, this existential involvement in the process of research, which is necessary for, in my opinion, for first person science. But then we come to the methodology. And the last lines of Mary Oliver's poem speak about that. So, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. So this is this huge ambiguity. First, it's not possible to do first-person science in my opinion. I'm going to stop repeating this in mind. This is just my modest view. It's not possible to do it if you are not engaged, if you are not existentially involved, if you are not aware that the stuff you are doing is going to change you, it's going to make you conscious differently. It's not that you strive, as you, I think, misunderstood me the first day, Nick, that you strive to become conscious. You're just aware you are. That's the sign of non-trivial phenomena. This is this being prepared to change. I don't know, perhaps you won't or whatever, but you are going into personal investigation. It's not somewhere there. That's what is meant by these lines. But then last line, when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. This is the methodological part. Let's stay here. So, learning how to see. In methodology department, which is totally wrong word for what I'm going to say now, but I would just like to do some sort of analogy with standard science. I can say only about two directions nothing of this is obligatory, nothing of this is recipe sort of stuff, nothing of this is actual method. It's just, I would suggest going there, my experience shows that going there is like a wise thing. So, first, I'm calling it learning how to see. It is, I called it also a phenomenological observation, or phenomenological kind of observation, bracketing, making space for stuff. So this is, when you have this phenomenon, trying to see it without this little nagging voice that wants to explain it or change it. This sort of stuff. It is extremely hard, and actually, it's when you are there, when you manage to do it, it is done. Then you get to the way of knowledge that we were just discussing, in my experience. So, this learning how to see is all, I mean, to go to more personal notes, this is actually why I think I'm doing this. This is something that I probably need, and I'm so much fascinating when this happens. When I can do it, or when I feel it, if I do it in dialogue with first person research with others. This is something that making space, making, just allowing things to be as they are, without this wish to change, even, especially if this is something really, really, existentially important for me, it is like the best stuff that can happen, and, this is the realization I was talking about. And now, I would just quickly go to the other direction, which is very much in line, I hope, with what you were saying, which was like being honest and sticking with the question. This is not two, these are not two different methods or principles. Actually, in my experience, they are both the same, or they go parallelly. So it is just the courage or guts to admit that I don't know. And to admit I don't know as long as it's important, as it's, until this view appears or something, a realization appears or whatever, until you know. So it is not the, in my experience, the first person investigation many times, it's not a gradual climbing. Sometimes it can also be, but sometimes it's just sticking with the question. Sticking with the question and with the don't know position. I don't know who, perhaps some of you saw the movie Meetings with Remarkable Men by Peter Brook. It's about Gurdjieff, or I don't know, Gurdjieff. Yeah. It's an interesting movie. I mean, I like Peter Brook very much, more than Gurdjieff. But the interesting stuff is that this actor who is coming from former Yugoslavia, Serbian person, he's tremendous. And he has this, he wants to know, it's about the life of Gurdjieff. And he wants to know, and then he does it for 10 years. And he really dedicates all his time, all his energy, all his money to research, to see what is true, studying books, going to some graves, trying to get some mystical symbols. And after 10 years, somebody asks him, so where did you get? He said, nowhere. He's just sticking with the question, and this energy still persists. This is what I mean with, you know, with this honesty and sticking. So you see, it's very much waving with hands. Although it's also very much existentially strong and true. I'm going to put it to discussion some other time, probably, but that's where I'm going to stop the methodological part. By this poem, the last one, please, Jack.
Someone else like to read it? Longing is the core of mystery. Longing itself brings the cure. The only rule is suffer the pain. Your desire must be disciplined, and what you want to happen in time, sacrifice.
So that sort of wraps it up for me. I wanted to talk also about the community and about intersubjectivity, but I think it's totally unfair to Matej that I do it, and I think he will do it. If not, I'm going to present this tomorrow when we're going to present our suggestion of first-person inquiry forum. So I'm going to say something about very drastic about intersubjectivity here in this area. So let's leave it there. Huh?
Okay.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Claire. I hope I didn't... but really, I like so much.
So let's take a short break. If we take a 10-minute break, really seriously a 10-minute break, so I'll start gathering people.
You should call it a 5-minute break.
Yes.
I don't know whether
okay,
you've
take
seen.
A 5-minute break.
Wonderful cartoon by Stephen. Make me think of you.
Thank you.
What's this?
She just
on fire.
And they there.
Now you can. I'll change. I'll take care. Okay, I'll take care of all this. I'll make a few changes.
Ways of seeing. I think that's right. That is very interesting.